The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 27/April 3, 2023. As usual, it is bordered in red on the front cover, with a narrow inner border of white. Time is in an off-white color, kind of a cloudy white color, in large block lettering. It's superimposed upon a cloudy blue background, upon which is an image of three pyramids of Giza. It's called The World's Greatest Places. It's called The Travel Issue, and I'm not sure we'll be moving into travel yet today. Beginning then with, oh, by the way, in the upper right-hand corner of the front cover, it says, Our 100th Year. Beginning with this edition of Time with the View essay, under which there's a smaller heading of Nation. Christian Revival's Unique Opportunity by Aaron Griffith. This is a two-page summary report called an essay. There's a photo that takes up about a third of the article. It's in color. I'll read the caption. It says, Students leading worship inside Hughes Chapel at Asbury University, February 17. It's a fairly traditional-looking, older traditional-looking sanctuary, lots of dark wood, lots of lights suspended from the ceiling, beige coloration in the walls. There's a gallery or a balcony, apparently a wraparound. I don't see this on all sides. In the front is a stage, what I would call the chancel, and the altar has become a stage. There's a stage grand piano in one corner, other instruments which appear to be, I'm not sure if they're acoustic or electric. It looks like electric because there are a lot of chords around. Singers in the front at a couple of music stands with microphones, of course. In the background, though, lots of pipes. This would be against the chancel wall that would typically have an altar in front of the wall. It has a lot of organ pipes. Whether they're in use or not is yet to be determined. And then above the pipes, there's an impression or an imprint into the dark wood that says, Holiness unto the Lord. It looks quite crowded. Again, I don't have a vantage point from this camera view of all the people, but it appears that there are numerous people standing, clapping, perhaps singing, on both the raked auditorium floor and the gallery. Christian Revival's Unique Opportunity by Aaron Griffith. Something happened at Asbury University. Many Christians called the weeks-long worship service at the small Wilmore, Kentucky school, which attracted tens of thousands and disrupted campus life, a revival. Fervent worship and prayer that began during a February 8, 2023 chapel service continued for hours afterward, then days, with word soon spreading globally through social media and national news coverage. Asbury administrators noting that the school and town had been overwhelmed by the rush of outside visitors, officially ended the on-campus revival gatherings February 24. But a number of other universities have reported their own enthusiastic campus awakenings, leading excited Christians to contend, this is evidence of an unprecedented movement of God across the nation. The revival has had its fair share of skeptics, however, many of whom argue this is but another instance of embarrassing evangelical behavior. Two general critical trends have emerged, each of which has roots in long traditions of revivalist reproval. The first worries that revivals like Asbury's lack moral seriousness. One need only think here of the stereotypical image of cash-grabbing prosperity preachers swindling their way through the revival circuit, or the exacting evangelicals visiting the restaurant after worship who don't tip. Or perhaps even worse, there's the fear such revivals are a cover or propellant for problematic politics, akin to the collective effervescence of a Trump rally. And to be sure, some MAGA-style public figures have hailed the happenings in Wilmore, seeing it as part of a larger political surge that bolsters the religious right. A second concern is that revivals like Asbury's are simply sites of emotional manipulation, that participants are being swept up in charismata that are artificial, designed to induce chill bumps on arms responses. If a revival is simply the powerful surge of collective emotion or the product of stagecraft, is it really real? Indeed, some revivalists from past generations grew quite comfortable with exploiting material means. The 19th century preacher Charles Finney penned a manual that spelled out how to lead an effective revival. He did not see this strategy as insincere, but frustrated critics cried manipulation. Similarly, any evangelical church musician knows if you hit the right chord at just the right moment, you are guaranteed more hands in the air. A student at the Christian college where I teach recently shared this concern with me when she spoke of her home church's routine revivalist stratagems, from the swells in worship music to lighting design. The Asbury revival appears decidedly low budget, without the fancy lights and rock show aesthetics of other charismatic events. But my student's concern is very real, given American evangelicalism's oversaturation of synthetic spirituality. Can we ever really be sure we are experiencing God? Christians from generations past have wrestled with both these problems. What is real awakening? What is artificial? Does revival require moral or political impact? And if so, what should it look like? The consensus interpretive key that most have landed on to address both concerns is to watch for the fruit of revival. A true revival produces results. Demonstrably changed lives oriented toward holiness and justice. Perhaps no American speaks of the hazards here as incisively as Frederick Douglass. In his 1845 narrative, the then enslaved Douglass discusses his enslaver, who had just experienced conversion at a Methodist revival. Douglass reports his hope that the revival might make his enslaver kinder, or even lead him to consider emancipation. But it did the opposite, making him more cruel and hateful in all his ways. We should attend to Douglass's warning. Even when we note the need for transformation, a revival can still conceal or enable oppression. But for Douglass, the answer was not to reject revival or Christianity outright. The answer was to point toward the Christianity of Christ, a religion characterized by love of neighbor and concern for the oppressed. Still, even keeping Douglass's admonition in mind, it is hard to know what to do. It is hard because, by definition, a revival transcends our human understanding and comprehension. Insofar as it might have direct political or moral import, to expect a revival to have a logical behavioral outcome is to reduce its power. Procedure easily eclipses Pentecost. Therefore, we might hope the Asbury revival results in dramatic social consequences, but we should be open to its resulting in changed lives that are surprising to us, that do not operate in accordance with given political preferences. For Douglass, true Christian revival logically entailed abolition, a movement that many of his day deemed strange and dangerous. We might wonder what needed threats to the contemporary status quo could emerge from Asbury, and be open to how they might challenge our expectations. Or perhaps we will not even know. Perhaps there will be no revolution in the streets, because those who attend the revival simply needed to feel God's love in their own hearts. I certainly pray for that feeling on my own campus. American young adults are overwhelmed and overstressed, burdened by a violent nation, economic precarity, destructive social media trends, mental health challenges, and general uncertainty about the future. When I asked Asbury Professor David Swartz about the campus happenings, he told me that before it became a public revival, this experience felt like a long exhale taken by my anxious students, reeling from the pressures of COVID-19 and social media, and then an infilling of a holy calm. Maybe then, the revival is not really about our own understanding as outsiders, our need to know if and how God is at work. Instead, it is about what the students at Asbury or other college campuses need, right here and now, and how God is meeting them where they are. We might then carefully embrace the possibility of spiritual awakening, even if we are not exactly sure from whence it came or where it is going. Of course, beautiful music and gathered community affect us. There is a reason why even the most avid secularist is moved at the sight of natural beauty, or why it is impossible to feel moved, as I have been, I admit, among a bunch of grooving hippies at a Phish concert. Christians have always been comfortable with the notion God is present and active amid the mundane and material. Think the bread and wine of the Eucharist, even if the how remains a mystery. The famed Harvard religion scholar Harvey Cox once wrote of a dinner gathering with similarly positioned, educated elites. I asked my table companions, if any of them had themselves ever spoken in tongues or prayed in the Spirit, as the Pentecostals say. He continued. There was an awkward silence. The priest glanced at his watch. The historian brushed crumbs from the tablecloth. The rest looked doubtfully at each other. None, it seemed, ever had, nor had I admitted. They seemed relieved. But then I asked whether anyone had ever wanted to. Here again the response was negative, and most seemed surprised when I revealed that I, at times, had wanted to. This captures something that I think is true about revivals. At the end of the day, they may be flawed. They may sometimes be infiltrated by bad actors or produce meager moral results. They may be emotionally manipulative. In that, they are human. And in that, they resemble all of us. But when one sees a person who's overcome with the Spirit, who knows God loves them and is working to transform their life for the good, the final word does not have to be interrogation or critique. Instead, it can be an opportunity for admiration or even aspiration. Aaron Griffith, the author, is professor of history at Whitworth University and author of God's Law and Order. From the brief Biden's Big Oil Truce by Justin Warland, Houston. Opening a wilderness of drilling, the president recasts relations with an industry he had vowed to phase out. The Biden administration's March 13 decision to approve the Willow Project, a multi-billion-dollar oil drilling development in the Alaskan wilderness, may have come as a shock to those accustomed to Joe Biden's criticism of the oil and gas industry. But it did not come out of nowhere. in the past 2 years, unforeseen circumstances, including energy prices and the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, have nudged the administration to work with oil companies. The Willow Project, spearheaded by ConocoPhillips, is just the latest development in the Biden administration's evolving relations with the industry. The dynamic was on full display earlier in the month at the world's most influential oil and gas conference, CERA Week, C-E-R-A, by S&P Global. Biden entered office promising to phase out oil and gas, but top administration officials still flew to Houston to make the case for oil and gas industry to embrace the transition from fossil fuels to green energy. "We need to not be polarized here," John Kerry, Biden's climate envoy, told a room packed with energy executives March 6. "We need to collaborate." The reasons for the détente are easy to understand on both sides. High energy prices have threatened the administration's economic goals, pressuring Biden to switch tactics. And it has not escaped the notice of oil companies that the IRA contains provisions that are well suited to implement and profit from. So while the administration and the industry may not be friends, circumstances have unfolded to make them not quite enemies either. How they navigate the complicated relationship will shape how the fight against climate change proceeds in the coming years. To understand how relations between Biden and the oil and gas industry have changed, it is helpful to look back in time. On the campaign trail, Biden promised to halt new drilling on federal land. And within days of taking office, he canceled the permit for Keystone XL oil pipeline, signaling he would resist the oil industry. At the time, the risks appeared minimal. Oil and gas seemed to be an industry in decline. The stock price of big energy companies had plunged. Oil prices were low, and so was what consumers paid at the pump. But that changed, first because of COVID-19 reopenings, and later because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. As energy prices skyrocketed, officials asked oil companies to ramp up drilling. The reception was chilly. The companies were already making solid profits, which stood to be reduced, both by the expense of drilling and by expanding supply. Then came the IRA, the biggest piece of climate legislation ever passed in the U.S. On the surface, it might seem as if big climate legislation would rankle the industry. Indeed, the law funds technologies that compete with oil and gas. But thanks in large part to West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin's sway over the text, the IRA is what energy experts describe as technology neutral. It funds wind and solar, yes, but other provisions actually invite the industry to play a role in the energy transition. The law includes tax incentives for companies that capture carbon dioxide. It subsidizes hydrogen production, and it supports the production of biofuels. Oil and gas companies have been working on those technologies for years, though much of it has lingered on the back burner. The promise of billions in federal incentives changes that calculation. You have the skill sets and knowledge to build some critical technologies at scale, Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm told the crowd at CERA Week. You now have 10 years of IRA carrots you can take to the bank. The industry sees the upside, too, now that the IRA is law. We believe there's opportunities within that legislation for our industry to continue to drive down emissions, says Frank Macciarola, Senior Vice President at the American Petroleum Institute. Plenty of conflict remains, even after the Willow approval. Also in March, Biden proposed axing fossil fuel subsidies as part of his budget, a statement of intentions given that Congress writes budgets. And the industry's lobbying on a range of regulations, not to mention how the IRA is implemented. Still, the reception to the full court press at CERAWeek was surprisingly warm. Gigantic conference rooms hosting Biden officials were packed, and officials received generous, if not zealous, applause. Jigar Shah, who's overseeing hundreds of billions of dollars in loans for clean energy projects as head of the Department of Energy's loan office, told attendees he noticed the enthusiasm. "People have been very open to asking me tough questions, which I feel is good," he said. "You know, they could just ignore me." All of this leaves the climate movement in somewhat of a strange place. The most significant climate law ever enacted relies, at least in part, on incumbent energy players embracing new technologies after decades of seeking to slow the energy transition. And those players now have significant financial incentives to decarbonize. At CERAWeek, Time asked John Podesta, the Biden advisor leading IRA implementation, about ties between the administration and the industry. "If they want to play clean," he said, "we welcome them to the party." Everything, every win. Oh, the last article again was written by Justin Warland, Houston. All right, this is a photograph. It's in color, but it's mostly black and white because it shows a few male subjects wearing black tuxedos and bow ties with white shirts. It shows a cameraman wearing all black, except for the red trim on his sneakers. It shows two women. One is black-haired. She's wearing a black sequined gown. The other is silver-gray-haired. She's wearing a silvery sequined pale beige gown. Everything, every win. Actors Ki Hui Kwan and Jamie Lee Curtis celebrate as Everything Everywhere All at Once wins Best Picture at the 95th Academy Awards, a film from directors Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert won the most category Oscars ever at the March 12 ceremony when it netted 7 awards in total, including Michelle Yeoh's historic Best Actress award. The Bulletin by Jeffrey Kluger. Scientists sound the alarm over a growing trash problem in space. 66 years ago, there was a single human-built object in Earth orbit, Sputnik, the world's first satellite. Today, there are 100 trillion objects circling the planet. That is the jaw-dropping number cited by international researchers in an open letter published March 9 in Science, calling for a global treaty to curb the ever-growing debris belt in low Earth orbit. The junk belt includes 9,000 active satellites. Then there are the spent boosters, stray bolts, floating paint chips that go along with launching all the hardware. Orbiting the Earth at 28,200 kilometers an hour, that's 17,500 miles per hour, even the smallest pieces of rubbish can strike an object like a bullet. Astronauts aboard the International Space Station must routinely shelter in the attached Soyuz or SpaceX spacecraft to wait out a passing swarm of debris in case the station gets catastrophically struck and they have to bail out in a hurry. Ultimately, the debris will fall back to Earth and incinerate in the atmosphere, but we are replacing the junk at a faster pace than orbits decay. The researchers liken the space trash problem to the mess we've made of the oceans. The difference? We've had centuries to follow the oceans and only decades to do the same in space. In March 2022, world leaders signed a global plastics treaty to curb mounting plastic waste in the oceans and eliminate what is already there. Similar initiatives should be taken now, the authors write, to implement treaties that hold both government and commercial space launch services liable for minimizing the amount of debris their launches create. Deorbiting satellites, after they've reached the end of their functional life, and developing technologies to clean up at least some of the rubbish. A species that is smart enough to reach space, certainly more difficult than learning to sail and follow the oceans, should be smart enough not to make a mess once it gets there. As Moriba Jaw, a co-author and associate professor of aerospace engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, put it in a statement, marine debris and space debris are both an anthropogenic detriment that is avoidable. And so 66 years ago, it would have been 1957, right? Here's the milestones page. Died Judy Heumann. I guess that's how to pronounce her name. H-E-U-M-A-N-N. Disability rights activist. This column is written by Rebecca Taussig. Taussig's author of Sitting Pretty, The View from My Ordinary Resilient Disabled Body. And there's a small inset photograph, probably of Judy Heumann. Yes, it is. And it is she in a wheelchair on a cover of Time magazine. The caption reads, Time selected Heumann for 1977 in its 100 Women of the Year project. When I learned that Judy Heumann had passed away March 4 at 75, I felt anxious in a way I struggled to explain. Judy became disabled by polio around the same time I became disabled by cancer, both as toddlers. Raised in 1950s Brooklyn, Judy grew up in a world that never expected her to join it. When her mom hoisted her up the stairs to their local school in her chair, the administrator refused to let her attend, saying Judy was a fire hazard. After a long fight and years later, Judy was allowed into a public school basement classroom with other disabled kids, ages 9 to 21. They did worksheets, took naps at their desks, and if they graduated, were expected to work in a sheltered workshop. It was like the world handed Judy the script for the story we are all playing out, assigning her the role of helpless cripple. Judy glanced at it, then set it on fire. Even as a child, she expected the world to bend to her story, not the other way around. I grew up in 1990s Kansas. I was able to go to school with my peers. There were curb cuts, accessible parking spaces, and a ramp at the library. Still, one of my earliest memories of my dad arguing with the staff of a roller rink, insisting it was perfectly safe to take me out on the rink in my hot pink wheelchair. They insisted it was not. We did not have to leave, we just couldn't participate. Of course we left. I learned to avoid occasions for sideline inclusion. And even today I know how much easier it is to skip the stairs and workarounds and just stay home. Judy believed in her story of belonging so deeply she demanded it be made a reality. She sued the New York City Board of Education when they denied her a teaching certificate because she could not walk. When she was removed from a plane for not having a support person, she sued the airline. In 1977, after waiting years for the government to sign regulations for Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, Judy led protesters into a federal building and refused to leave. After nearly a month, they got the signature they needed. This resistance led directly to the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, one of the most comprehensive pieces of civil rights legislation for disabled people. It was signed when I was 4. But the scripts Judy set on fire did not disappear. Rewriting the story of disability for a society takes relentless tending and insisting. In 2017, there was an unsuccessful push in Congress to diminish some of the power of the ADA. People with disabilities experience higher rates of poverty and incarceration and are less likely to attend college and are two times as likely to be unemployed as our non-disabled counterparts. One in four American adults has a disability, but the fullness of our lives is rarely represented on screen. The tightness in my chest when I learned of Judy's death was fear. What will happen to the story of our belonging without her bold voice? A few years ago, I moderated a panel she was on and watched as she commanded the conversation, even from a Zoom screen. Her vision for what the future could be, a world where everyone is included, was so vivid. I believe her voice will only grow stronger with time because the story she brought us is true. We belong. We belong. We belong here. And the writer was Rebecca Tausig, speaking of the death of Judy Human. Resumed. This is the milestones column. Diplomatic relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia after talks mediated by the Chinese government in Beijing. March 10. The Gulf arch rivals severed relations in 2016. Launched. Two cruise missiles from a submarine by North Korea, March 12, about a day ahead of joint U.S.-South Korean military drills. Convicted. Prominent South Carolina attorney Alex Murdaugh of the 2022 murder of his wife and son, March 3. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Celebrated the 10th anniversary of his papacy by Pope Francis, March 13. Died, pioneer for women and family rights in Congress, former Colorado Democratic Representative Pat Schroeder, at 82, March 13. Inventor of the high jump technique, the Fosbury flop, American Olympic champion Dick Fosbury, at 76, March 12. Turning the page to a two-page article, the brief news, Climate, a Solar Revolution Driven by Power Cuts, by Adam Razmi, Beirut. There's a photo here of a lot of solar panels in kind of a fun ride patio or pavilion. And this whole area is surrounded by high rises and then low rises right at a beachfront. It is solar panels at Beirut's Luna Park Amusement Center. About 2,300 feet above Beirut in the Matin District Mountains, Roger Maslam and his brother Elias greet me on an unusually balmy winter day as they chop wood to help keep their early 20th century home warm before the cold returns. I am no match for these burlier Lebanese men who grew up in Brumana, a town about a dozen miles east of the Lebanese capital, but I take my turn, meekly swinging an axe at the tree stump before us. After a lackluster start and plenty of patience from the pair, something akin to firewood begins to splinter off. Roger takes me through the family home's front door, past a living room with traditional Lebanese floor tiles and artwork dedicated to Om Kulthum, the Egyptian titan of Arabic music, and up the stairs to the roof. The pine-covered mountains and the Mediterranean Sea are a pleasant distraction, but the real purpose of the tour is to see the 18 solar panels slightly obscuring the vista. Like tens of thousands of Lebanese people, the Muslims have turned to solar power to generate reliable and cost-effective electricity in a crisis-stricken state that provides as little as 1 hour of power a day. In the past, even when the situation was normal, we used to have 5, 6, 7 hours of power cuts a day, says Roger, as the three of us sip Arabic coffee on their balcony. He's referring to the period before an economic crisis began in 2019 that has seen the Lebanese lira lose more than 98% of its value against the U.S. dollar. The state-run Électricité du Liban, EDL, has a generation capacity of around 1,800 megawatts, according to Pierre Khoury, director of the Lebanese Center for Energy Conservation, LCEC, compared with the 2,000 to 3,000 MW the country needed before the crisis. But EDL provides only around 250 MW today because the government struggles to pay for the imported fuel used to power the country's main electricity plants. I lean over while Elias, a civil engineer by training, pulls out his Android phone. As the TBB Nova app he uses to manage the Mazlum solar power system shows, the 18 panels are generating over 1 kilowatt per hour, enough to power their large, multi-generational home. He says the solar panels and battery system, installed in July 2020 at a cost of over $10,000, are saving the family between $3,000 and $4,000 a year in electricity and generator bills. But the main thing is reliability, Elias says. For the last 2 years, we basically did not have power cuts. The Mazlums are hardly alone in Lebanon. Solar panels have cropped up across the country over the past 2 years, from the rooftops of rural households and family-run businesses to urban apartments and multinational organizations. The country generated zero solar power in 2010, but had 90 MW, I think it's megawatts, of solar capacity in 2020. 100 MW were added in 2021 and 500 MW more in 2022. Khoury says the LCEC believes Lebanon could source 30% of its energy from renewables by 2030, which the government committed to in 2018, with solar power being one major contributor. Atop several campus buildings at Sagesse University in Fern El Chebak, a suburb southeast of Beirut, row upon row of solar panels gleam under the bright afternoon sun. The Catholic University, home to some 3,500 students, is one of the many organizations in Lebanon that have turned to solar power. When I visit, Salim Nasser, a project manager at ME Green, is overseeing the last few steps of the installation of around 460 panels. We are talking about 300 kW peak, kilowatt peak, on a sunny day like this, Nasser says, which is enough to power everything, including lights, chillers, ACs, refrigerators, coolers, heaters. To keep costs down, the university has opted not to install a battery. The campus still relies on generators, but the panels cut their use by around 70%, an enormous financial saving, not to mention the green benefits of using less diesel. Laura Bustani, president of Sagesse, says the decision to install the solar power system is part of a wider green initiative on campus. But we started with solar energy sooner than expected because of the lack of electricity in Lebanon, she says. ME Green, which launched in 2010, was one of the early solar power firms in Lebanon, but the sector has ballooned from around 150 registered businesses in 2020 to more than 800 today. These companies work on everything from small household systems, which start at $2,000 to $3,500, to projects involving hundreds of panels or more. We wanted to start in Lebanon because you have an energy problem and you have renewable energy resources with more than 300 days of sunshine, says Philippe El Khoury, co-founder of ME Green. Yet he and others quoted in this story have mixed feelings about the solar power boom. On one hand, they say it has undeniable environmental benefits. On the other hand, the benefits are piecemeal. EDL's failure to provide electricity, coupled with a lack of large-scale solar farms and green infrastructure, means that overall Lebanon still relies more on heavily polluting generators. The amount of CO2 you're reducing from using solar panels, you're also turning on diesel generators for longer, says Mark Ayoub, an energy expert at the American University of Beirut. The real green solution, Ayoub says, needs to come at the community level, villages, municipalities, regions. This is where you start having a big environmental impact. But these kinds of projects need a level of investment that Lebanon's cash-strapped government cannot deliver. Foreign lenders could step in, but experts say most are reluctant until the country finalizes a deal with the International Monetary Fund. Talks over a $3 billion loan, contingent on reforms, have been sluggish. In the meantime, ME Green and other small companies are continuing to encourage solar power in Lebanon. El Khoury, the ME Green executive, sees every installation that his company completes as a victory against diesel-spewing generators. Every time I kill a generator, I'm very happy, he says. This is my mission, kill the generator. It helps that solar power is now the most affordable source of new electricity globally, thanks to rapid technology gains and a glut in solar panel production. Back at the Mazlum's balcony, as we have our last sips of coffee, Elias says they hardly use generators anymore because, one, the sound, two, the maintenance, and three, it is not as efficient and reliable as the solar system. It is a conclusion many in Lebanon have come around to, regardless of the environmental considerations. People are seeing the real benefits, he says. Look, at the end of the day, we are becoming green without even noticing it. This article, again, was written by Adam Rosmi, Beirut. Oh, here's another little story. Five health benefits of houseplants by Angela Haupt. Five benefits of houseplants, which I unfortunately can't keep alive. Collecting and caring for houseplants boomed in popularity during the pandemic, especially among younger adults without abundant outdoor space. Americans spent $8.5 billion more on gardening-related items in 2020 than in 2019, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Vibrant communities blossomed on social media, like the Plant Talk corner of TikTok, uniting plant parents and making it easy to swap tips and mail one another cuttings. The consensus among these enthusiasts, plants are an accessible, interesting way to make an otherwise drab space more inviting, and there's a unique thrill to watching them grow. Plus, there is a robust body of research indicating they make us happier and healthier. I tell people, let them bring you to life the way you do to them, says Libby Bowles, who opened Fancy Leaf Plant Company in Parrish, Florida in 2021. One, these are the benefits. They are soothing. We hold our stress hormone, cortisol, in our saliva, And we know this is decreased when we're around plants, says Melinda Newth, an assistant professor of horticultural science at North Carolina State University. Even looking at photos of plants has shown to have a positive impact on stress levels. In one study, when people in a hospital waiting room were exposed to either a real plant, a poster of a plant, or no nature, researchers found that both the real plants and the posters were linked with lower levels of stress. Now, there are a few illustrations on this page, mostly of green plants with big green leaves, but here's one with some medium-sized green leaves in a yellow pot and purple flowers on top, and it says orchid. Orchids can be slightly tricky to care for, but the payoff of fragrance and flowers is worth it. Here at the NCRS office and studios, our director, May Tran, has orchids on her desk. Two, they can sharpen attention. Numerous studies have suggested greenery is restorative and increases the ability to concentrate, including among kids. One found elementary school age kids in classrooms with a green wall, a vertical garden where living plants cover an indoor wall, scored better on measures of focused attention than kids in standard classrooms. Newth says she has 50 to 60 plants at home and 45 in her university office. The research supporting attention and concentration is one of the reasons I justify having so many, she says. Three, they may speed up healing. Plants may quicken recovery from an illness, injury, or surgery. According to one paper, hospitalized people who had a view of plants or trees were calmer and had better clinical outcomes, including a reduced need for pain medication and a shorter hospital stay compared with those who did not. They found that simply looking at plants had some benefits, says Derek Stowell, past president of the American Horticultural Therapy Association. Four, they can boost happiness. The unofficial motto of the plant-loving community is, plants make people happy. It is true. In one experiment, people who spent 5 to 10 minutes in a room with a few houseplants felt happier than those in a plant-free room. One research review found feelings of comfort and positivity increase the longer you spend with plants. The authors noted purple and green plants were particularly effective at reducing negative feelings. Being around plants is also linked with greater self-esteem and life satisfaction. There is an evolutionary response when you see green. It's almost like you created yourself a sanctuary, says Gary L. Altman, associate director of the Horticultural Therapy Program at Rutgers University. It reduces feelings of fear and anxiety, and even if you are angry, it will calm you down. And finally, five, they brighten up indoor life. According to the results of one study conducted during stay-at-home orders in Bulgaria, people who had houseplants or a garden experienced fewer symptoms of depression and anxiety than those who did not. The study authors theorized that this was in part because houseplants encourage feelings of being away while at home, providing welcome relief during prolonged periods in the same space. From the brief news, good question, why aren't there any houses to buy, by Alana Samuels. Mortgage rates are rising and the housing market appears to be softening nationwide. But in many U.S. markets, would-be buyers are facing a big problem. There's just nothing to buy. Housing inventory, the number of homes on the market, has been falling since the rebound from the Great Recession, as investors snapped up homes and more older Americans decided to age in place. Some housing analysts predicted inventory would start to climb as builders scrambled to finish more new homes. But in markets where there is not a lot of new construction, inventory is hovering near historic lows, according to data crunched by Redfin and provided to Time. "I do not think I've ever seen it this bad," says Becky Colatis, who's been a real estate agent in Hartford, Connecticut for 23 years. In December, Hartford had just 1.4 months of housing supply, meaning it would take just 1.4 months to sell all the homes on the market at the current pace of demand. In February 2019, by contrast, it had 5.9 months supply. In decades past, economists would say a balanced housing market has 4 to 6 months of supply. One reason inventory is so low nationally is many homeowners were able to lock in record low interest rates in 2020 and 2021. Mortgage rates have skyrocketed since then. The rate for a 30-year fixed mortgage reached 6.7% March 9, nearly double that of a year ago, according to Freddie Mac. That means homeowners who bought or refinanced with low interest rates are reluctant to sell their homes and buy another with a mortgage with a much higher rate. The low inventory makes house hunting an even more painful and emotionally charged process than usual. Buyers have to choose between paying a high price for available inventory and waiting, potentially for a long time. In January, the lowest inventories in the nation's 100 largest metro areas were in Rochester, New York, Buffalo, New York, Allentown, Pennsylvania, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Worcester, Massachusetts, Greensboro, North Carolina, Hartford, Boston, and Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. Aside from Boston, these are not markets typically mentioned in the same sentence as housing crunch. But there are a few reasons these northeastern metropolitan areas are seeing such low supply, says Daryl Fairweather, Redfin's chief economist. First, they are seen as relatively affordable. So people who've been priced out of places like New York City are heading to smaller markets to be able to own a house. Second, they are in the dense Northeast, where there is not a lot of land to build on, so there's not a lot of new construction happening. A third reason is the influx of investors who've bought properties, including single-family homes, to rent. Investors bought 24% of all single-family homes in 2021, up from around 15% to 16% each year, going back to 2012, according to a Pew Stateline analysis. Institutional investors are making this market more difficult, says Peter Chabris, a real estate agent in Cincinnati, where in February, three homes went into contract for every new one that was listed, he says. It is stressful. It is highly competitive. It is emotionally challenging. It is also something buyers across the country are going to reckon with as spring, the traditional home buying season, approaches, or is here, and mortgage rates continue to rise. The Federal Reserve has steadily raised interest rates in an effort to tame inflation, and Fed Chair Jerome Powell suggested in recent congressional testimony the agency would likely need to continue to ratchet up those rates. Winifred Jones has been trying to buy a home for 6 years. She wants a multifamily property in Hartford so that her adult children can live with her and have their own space. Every year, she says, there's been more competition and more investors outbidding her with cash. She and her real estate agent are now trying to find would-be sellers before they officially list their properties for sale. She is not optimistic. There's just nothing to bid on, she says. There's just nothing to bid on. It's either way overpriced or not worth it for the money. This article will be abridged for time purposes. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Netanyahu faces his biggest test yet. After more than 15 years spread across three separate runs as Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu has plenty of hard-won political experience. He's never needed it more. Deadly confrontations between Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank have been building for the past year. As in the past, Israeli defense forces claim to have killed militants, while Palestinians charge many civilians are among the dead. The result, the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has called 2022 the deadliest year in the West Bank and East Jerusalem in nearly 20 years, with an estimated 154 Palestinians killed. Palestinian attacks killed 25 Israelis and foreign nationals in the same period. So far this year, Israelis have killed 80 Palestinians, and Palestinian attacks have killed 14 Israelis. Even more startling is the increasingly intense political battle among Israelis over changes proposed by Netanyahu to the authority of Israeli courts. His government has proposed a plan that would strip Israel's Supreme Court of much of its power in three ways. First, it would allow Knesset, Israel's parliament, to override court decisions with a simple majority vote. Second, it would end the Supreme Court's right to strike down pieces of legislation the court finds incompatible with Israel's basic laws, which serve as the country's constitution. Third, it would give elected officials a greater role in selecting judges who serve on the court. Supporters of the plan say it is a long overdue reform that will limit the ability of unelected judges to wield unchecked power over legislation created by the people's chosen representatives. That is especially true for those who say the court is dominated by activist judges who rule against them on immigration laws, West Bank settlement policies, and military conscription for the ultra-Orthodox. Critics charge Netanyahu, who's on trial now for allegations of corruption, wants to remove checks and balances on his power, dangerously undermining Israeli democracy by allowing any government that can muster 61 of 120 Knesset votes to enact whatever it can pass. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.